Hey, cashiers. We Have the Receipts podcast is coming at you live from Netflix is a Joke Fest in Los Angeles.
Chris, are you kidding?
No, Netflix is a joke, Courtney, but this is not one of them. Our listeners in LA have the chance to join us for a live recording of our podcast, We Have the Receipts, hosted by me, Chris Burns.
And me, Courtney Revolution.
Join us and a few surprise guests from your favorite Netflix reality shows on Saturday, May 4th at 1 p.m. at a secret location in Hollywood.
To be announced.
Get your tickets for the We Have the Receipts live show at tudum.com/WHTR. That's Tudum, TUDUM.com/WHTR.
Tickets are limited. If you can't make it to the show, we still want to hear your beautiful voice. Leave us a message at speakpipe.com/WeHaveTheReceipts.
You may even hear your own voice on the show.
Grab a ticket at tudum.com/WHTR.
And we'll see you on May 4th in Los Angeles. Bye, cashiers.
Hi, just a heads up before we start. There's a brief discussion of suicide in this episode. If you or someone you know is struggling with thoughts of suicide, information and resources are available at www.wantotalkaboutit.com. That's www.wantotalkaboutit.com.
Welcome back to episode 4 of Waco, American Apocalypse, the companion podcast series. With me again today is Lee Hancock.
Waco was live on television over everybody's lunch hour. You could watch this thing unfold from the very beginning, from February 28th. When all of a sudden, you know, people getting home from church or waking up or whatever they were doing, all of a sudden they were seeing breaking news bulletins with this shootout live on television. And then over your lunch hour, 51 days later, you could watch as this building went up in flames with 80 people inside. So it wasn't just a trauma for the people that were involved or who witnessed it firsthand. It was a trauma for the entire country. And it was a story that was so complicated, it was hard to get arms around. And very quickly, elements of the story, you know, were adopted or hijacked, if you will, by different groups who wanted to use the Davidians as poster children. The NRA very quickly came in. Other gun groups came in. Tax protesters. You know, there was enough that was traumatic and was unresolved and enough questions around it and the feeling that the feds were not being forthcoming about why they did what they did, how they handled it, and particularly how they made mistakes.
It's almost like a Rorschach inkblot where whatever you want to see in it based on your political persuasion, you are able to see. You can draw conclusions about the right to bear arms. You can draw conclusions about the right to worship God as you want. You can draw conclusions about the federal government. And people look at Waco and draw these conclusions. And then from Waco, there's a direct link on to Oklahoma City 2 years later, April 19th. And you articulate this, you know, beautifully in the film, but summarize it again briefly for us here so we understand the connections between Oklahoma and Waco.
One of the people that came in early April to see what was happening, to protest, was Tim McVeigh, who was an Army veteran who had gotten increasingly interested in white supremacist beliefs and very concerned that the feds were going to take away guns, that they were going to come and do assaults, much like what happened in Waco, that this was going to happen elsewhere. And then after the fire happened on April 19th, McVeigh was absolutely convinced that something needed to happen to pay back or teach the government a lesson. And if it was done well enough, it might touch off a revolution. He picked out the federal building in Oklahoma City as a site to do that, in part because he thought that some of the ATF agents who were housed in that building had helped plan the raid there. He also saw Oklahoma City as important because that's where Bob Ricks was headquartered. Bob Ricks, who in Waco was the chief spokesman for much of the siege. He did a lot of the morning briefings.
Now let's hear from Bob Ricks, who's joining us to talk about the lasting impact of Waco and how it's influenced what happened in Oklahoma City. How much does this story haunt you? How frequently do you think of Waco? You know, how much does it enter your consciousness? Or have you also, you know, had to sort of put it in the rear view? What's your emotional connection?
Well, it's one obviously I can't dwell on. It's not healthy to continue to dwell on it, but it sometimes will come back at odd times. I've gone back to where the Branch Davidian compound was located on two occasions. The first time was about 10 years afterward. It took me that long to do it. And then I just went back this last year. To me, as you were saying, it's kind of part of the healing process to not try to suppress it, but to address it. That it is still there. It is very real. It affected people's lives. It caused the loss of life. It affected me. Affected my career. It affected the FBI. So it was one of the most dramatic events that I've ever experienced, as well as and also the FBI.
In many ways, although it was secondhand, you know, I was a kid growing up in Dallas, Texas, and it was this iconic event. And I hope, like you said, on a greater cultural level, the retelling of this story helps us process it. And really with the intention of so that history doesn't repeat itself.
Yeah, that's I think that's true as well, though. We were just people. We got caught after the ATF raid in a dilemma that I don't know still to the day. I try to come up with solutions that could have ended this peacefully. And it still to this day, I can't come up with ones that would end this in a peaceful manner. So you had human beings who were doing their best, and there was no one of ill will in that whole process. Everyone in there was trying to resolve this peacefully. What can we do to end this, to get this over with, to save the children? And what is the least oppressive manner that we can try to carry this out, but still at the same time force the people to eventually come out? What can we do to end this? And again, the whole time of the standoff, we never fired one shot during the entire standoff. We even had our agents at the end that were risking their own life going in the building and pulling people out that were still firing at us. And not that I'm trying to say, okay, don't blame me, blame them. It's just that if I could have people understand the picture, is that you had hundreds of people who were working every day, giving everything that they had, trying to resolve this incident peacefully. But it was an incident that we had one person that was in control and made the decision that none of his followers were going to come out, that they were going to be totally loyal to him to the very end. And that's why it was called the Ranch Apocalypse. He wanted to bring this down to one magnificent end, and he believed that that would be in support of him and almost in worship of him as well.
What are the falsehoods, rumors, conspiracy theories that you would like to categorically lay to rest? You know, what would you like the world to know? Hey, here's what people say. Here's what the truth is.
Yeah, you know, I've heard so many. I don't know that I can address them all, but some of the most patently false ones are that the FBI started the fire. We did not start the fire. We had our airplane overhead called the Night Stalker. It was circling and it was taking pictures the whole time. We also had listening devices that they were rudimentary. We didn't have live transmissions of the information at the time, but following review, we had statements in there, you know, light it up. Is it lit yet? We need more fuel oil to keep the fire going. Our airplane showed that they had three simultaneous spots where the building was lit, that we had, in fact, carried out executions of those inside, all totally false. the executions were carried out by David Koresh and his followers. Some of the mothers wanted to bring their children out, but they were not allowed to because those were David Koresh's children, and they were going to die with him. The main thing that I want to say is that we did everything in our power not to cause the fire and to try to prevent that from occurring and use the least amount of pressure that we could, which was just an insertion of tear gas, which is probably going to occur somewhere in the United States today. It is a standard procedure. We used it regularly at the Edmond Police Department, where I was chief of police after my service here. And it's used by police throughout the country. But these were not criminals. These were devout religious people who were totally devoted to their cause. They believed greatly in the teachings of David Koresh, and this what was happening, and we actually helped him to fulfill what he was preaching, that he was the second coming, that he was going to usher in the end times, and that it was going to be a great battle with the federal government. And all this did actually come true. I mean, it was in that respect, it was somewhat amazing that a lot of what he prophesied did eventuate.
By the time, you know, bodies are exhumed and forensic work is done, how does David Koresh die in the end?
David Koresh was shot with a rifle. And the coroner's office ruled it a suicide. But I've never seen anyone take a rifle and shoot themselves between the eyes. I mean, people have committed suicide many times with rifles, but I've never seen them take it and fire between the eyes. In fact, it's very awkward. Steve Snyder, my personal belief, is shot David Koresh between the eyes and then killed himself. I also believe that we believed it was going to be like a Jim Jones situation where Jim Jones had everybody commit suicide, and then he was saying, okay, now we've proved our point. He was not going to commit suicide. He was forced to commit suicide. And I believe some of that perhaps may have occurred here, that a lot of our psychologists believe that David Koresh would have everybody kill themselves and then he would walk out and be the hero. My personal belief is Steve Snyder says that's not going to happen. Everybody was dying and David Koresh was going to walk out. I think Steve Snyder said that's not acceptable and killed him and then killed himself.
Tell us, why the hell are we still talking about this story 30 years later? What is it about the kind of cultural fascination with this story that we're still wrestling with it?
I think it was such a dramatic event that the way it was ended, and also the conspiracy theories that sprang up surrounding both Oklahoma City and Waco. The conspiracy theories were not challenged by the FBI. They were allowed to linger and fester and actually grow when some of them were just so preposterous that they should have been shot down. But the FBI thought better not to say anything. And as a result, I think there's still questions that arise to this day about what actually happened at Waco and Oklahoma City to some degree.
So you bring up a couple of fascinating points that I'd like to explore a little bit further. One is this legacy of conspiracy theories and fear, I guess, of a sort of deep state and government overreach. And there is this legacy from Waco to Oklahoma City, the Oklahoma City bombing, to, you know, all the way through January 6th and the kind of current culture. What exactly produced the sort of speculative conspiracy theories, and why has this gripped the American public so much?
I think what produced it was this underground current there, that there was this deep state, that there was an inherent distrust of the government and what the government was saying, that there were factions within the government that were out to suppress First Amendment, Second Amendment rights, that we were en route to a totalitarian system and that this was just one of the initial steps that the government was taking to clamp down on religious freedoms and freedom to bear arms. And these are all hot button items, obviously, that are very emotional amongst many people. Because the FBI did not respond with what the facts were, those became actually, in some cases, in some areas, as taken as gospel, that's what actually occurred, which was just so far-fetched it was not believable.
Why do you think the FBI didn't shoot down the, you know, speculations and conspiracies around this? What was the thinking institutionally?
I think institutionally they just wanted it to go away. You had a change in leadership. You had a new director that had come on board, and his hope was that the Waco would not be tied to him. Just let it be blamed on the prior administration, and let's go forward and act like it didn't occur. But it did occur. And it was a big moment in U.S. history that still lingers.
It's an interesting place that you're in, right? Like, on the one hand, there is chatter that, hey, maybe something's coming. Maybe there are going to be reprisals from Waco. And yet, at the same time, you're muzzled in your ability to, like, make a public response to that. So what's that like for you, you know, particularly being the voice in the face of this?
Yeah, it was extremely frustrating because it was very real in this part of the country. I think, you know, sometimes people live in that ivory tower back in Washington, D.C., New York area, and they think that whatever is of importance there is what is important to the rest of the country. You know, issues remain important in Washington, D.C. for about 2 weeks normally, and then something other dramatic issue takes its place. But out here, the events in Waco were still very heated. So it really reached its peak more about the first year anniversary. One example, I had Janet Reno visit my office in Oklahoma City. I was the agent in charge of the Oklahoma City FBI office. And she asked for general questions from agents and others. And I raised the issue. I said, I know it's not a big issue in Washington, D.C., but it is a huge issue here in the Oklahoma City and Midwest, the events that occurred at Waco. And there are so many false theories out there that, you know, this claiming that the government executed these people. It's such an emotional issue that I believe the government should respond. And her response was that, I don't think people care about Waco anymore. And I think that we shouldn't discuss it. So I had no choice but to continue the silence that surrounded what we had done at Waco, which I thought was the wrong approach.
So let's cut all the way to today. And when the uprising at the Capitol January 6th is happening, how much do you feel like the legacy of Waco, Oklahoma City, how much does that current of right-wing extremist fear, anger, how much does that feed into the events of January 6th? And is this a cultural stream that we saw, you know, the dam finally bursting there?
Yeah, you know, I didn't put the two together, to be honest, and I still don't. And a lot of it is because of the events that occurred. The events that transpired at the Oklahoma City bombing were by a very small handful of people. They were not organized groups at all. In fact, they belonged to no organization. And what I saw at the Capitol was more of a... There were a lot of loose individuals there that just joined into the fracas and wanted to participate and felt they were drawn to it. But then you had groups such as the Proud Boys and others such as that were using it to carry out their message, and it had been something that they had planned for a period of time. So to me, it wasn't the same type of scenario that we witnessed at Oklahoma City.
What is the institutional legacy of this? That is to say, what is the impact on federal law enforcement, whether it be the ATF or the FBI? Like, what is the net effect of Waco? How does it affect or change the Bureau itself? And what is the lasting institutional change?
Well, you know, in some respects, as I somewhat indicated, the Bureau was slow to even address it. In fact, normally we do an after-action review on any major assault that we take, even a SWAT team action, which I usually headed up anytime we deployed our SWAT team. We would always sit down afterwards and do an after-action review just to see how the plan was drafted and was it executed properly and where were the deficiencies. And there always are deficiencies. And we couldn't get our headquarters to actually do that. It took over a year, and we went and met at Quantico for one afternoon, which is unbelievable for an event of that magnitude, and just did a cursory overview of what had happened. And it was clear to me that there was no interest in doing a thorough review from a tactical point of view. The other ones are all trying to be looking at fault finding. And that's not what we do in after action reports. We're trying to say, okay, we do look at where faults occur, but what can we do to make it stronger? Even on highly successful raids that we've taken, there's always something you can improve on. It's usually in the communication side. That's always where we're deficient. But there are other things about command and control and how could this have been executed better? What could we have done in Waco? Maybe that we could have had a different result. But those reviews were never done.
It sounds like there was this, and understandable, frankly, hey, this is a black eye for the Bureau. Let's just put it in the rearview mirror, right, and hopefully this will go away if we put our heads in the sand.
I think that's exactly what the approach was just the new administration came in and didn't want to be tagged with what had happened at Waco and said, you can blame the FBI, but don't blame me because I wasn't there.
Well, I'm very grateful for your time, your openness, your candor, and your service, frankly. And it's been a pleasure and an honor to get to know you. And I hope that we have the chance to do some press interviews when the time
All
comes
right.
together.
Okay.
All right, Bob. Take care.
Take care.
When I asked Ricks if he saw a connection between Waco and January 6th, Lee, he was quick to point out the ways in which they were different. But I think for many people, the events of Waco are a defining moment, the beginning of a new strain of distrust of government, and like Ricks was saying, the start of many of the unfounded conspiracy theories that persist today. What do you think?
To follow the past from 1993 to January 6th, you had in Columbine, literally, they had planned to do their attack on their high school on April 19th. The only reason why they didn't is they felt like they needed more ammunition. But they wanted to choose that date because that was the date that McVeigh had chosen, and that was when Waco had happened. Eric Rudolph, the Olympic bomber in Atlanta who bombed Centennial Park in Atlanta in 1996. In 1997, he also attacked a gay bar in Atlanta and sent a message to the police while he was on the run. And he said he was going to use April 19th, 1993 as his code. So when he was in contact with the authorities or the media, they would know it was him. You had other groups that seized on this and were inspired by it. You had the Bundys, who first were in Oregon with the standoff in Oregon, also the standoff in Nevada. One of the reasons why so many people rallied to their side with heavy armament was they were determined that they were not going to let the feds do to them what had happened in Waco. So, you know, people saw this as both, you know, a tragedy that could have been prevented and unfinished business that they were not going to let happen again. And these groups went from marginal, even fringe groups to, with the rise of the internet and social media, they were able to talk to each other and spread their information. You know, where much of what is thought about Waco if history is what's remembered, as some people say, what people remember about Waco often has more to do with conspiracy theories than the actual facts of what happened.
To bring it back sort of full circle,
sure.
I think that it's really... I think this is one of the animating ideas, you know, that inspired us as filmmakers in this story is instead of treating this story as a symbol of whatever your politics are, and, you know, that is the beauty of this country, that you are able to hold these conflicting, you know, intensely oppositional ideas. But I think, you know, what the intention of the series is to look at people as human beings, to not treat them as symbols, and to understand the nuance and the complexity of it. And hopefully, you know, the goal, I think, and where we are as a society is we need less screaming arguments and more nuanced conversations about things, because that's where the truth lies. It's almost always in that gray area in between, and finding that ability to both firmly hold a belief, but hear somebody else, and to do it with respect and love and humanity. Lee, thank you very much for your time and thoughts and insights. So grateful to have had the chance to work with you on the series and on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Tiller. I'm really grateful to you and your whole crew for bearing witness to this important part of American history.
Waco, American Apocalypse is a production of Netflix, Original Productions, and Tillerman Films. Producer is Jacob Miller. Executive producers are Tiller Russell, Brian Lovett, Jeff Hassler, and Jennifer Dugan. Edited by James Carroll. Special thanks to Lee Hancock.